This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's a basic lesson in politics. If you're a national leader of a country with huge economic trouble, it may be a bad time to go on an extravagant elephant hunt. That is exactly what the King of Spain did, spending almost $60,000, more than twice the average Spanish salary, at a time when almost a quarter of all workers there have no job at all. The Spanish public only found out about this trip because the king broke his hip and had to be airlifted home. Lauren Freyer has the story.
For a man used to pomp and paparazzi, King Juan Carlos looked shaken, emerging from a hospital Wednesday after hip surgery. I'm very sorry, he said, blinking into the cameras, sheepish and leaning on his crutches. I made a mistake and it won't happen again. The royal palace confirmed this is the first time any Spanish king has ever said he's sorry, at least publicly, for anything.
I think it's not enough.
Rafa Lucia is a social worker smoking outside a Madrid library in the rain. He's been jobless for months. The government cut his local school's budget by 30%, but the royal palace's budget?
They cut just the 2%. And now this is like the government doesn't cut to them, and then he's spending the money in Africa killing elephants.
Spaniards can't decide which would be worse, whether the king might have spent public money on his jaunt to Botswana last week, or whether it was paid by an Arab businessman courting favor, as some reports say. Either way, there are calls for the king's abdication. Maybe it wouldn't be so bad if the king hadn't recently given a speech calling on Spanish leaders to set an example of modesty amid recession. He also said he loses sleep worrying about how many Spanish youth are unemployed, 50% of them. Sharon Nunez is an animal rights activist who organized a protest outside the king's hospital this week. Volunteers lined the street with photos of maimed elephants and water buffalo.
That's the funny, the ironic thing about it is we have someone who's going out killing elephants, killing animals, and he's representing an international environmental organization.
It's inconvenient, but true. The king is honorary president of the World Wildlife Fund in Spain, which proved particularly awkward when a snapshot of Juan Carlos began circulating online this week. It shows him posing in front of an elephant he shot dead in Botswana in 2006. WWF's conservation director for Spain, Enrique Segovia, says he's requested an audience with the king to discuss whether he'll keep that post. We've had many, many complaints from members, he says. The image of the king hunting elephants, it's incongruent with an organization like ours that defends elephants. Spain's monarchy is mostly symbolic but well-respected. Juan Carlos was hand-picked by General Francisco Franco to lead Spain after the dictator's 1975 death, and he's credited with easing the transition to democracy here. But college student Roy Alexander Buza says times have changed.
It's true that all people here in Spain appreciate the work that the king did in the transition, but I think that we are now in another time. The transition is the past, and the king has to do efforts like the rest of the citizens.
It's been a tough year for Spain's royals. The king's son-in-law is the subject of a corruption probe, and last week police began investigating an incident involving the king's underage grandson. The 13-year-old recently shot himself in the foot, literally. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Earth Day is Sunday. In anticipation of that, we're going to spend some time revisiting one of the worst environmental disasters in our nation's history, the BP oil spill. It's been exactly 2 years since the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded some 50 miles off the Louisiana coast. It dumped millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, killed 11 workers, and dramatically changed the lives of so many others. In a few minutes, we will check in with a man who owns an oyster business in Louisiana. He's still struggling to recover, especially because oysters take years to mature. But first, we want to talk about how families have been coping. More than 1,000 residents took part in a survey shortly after the oil spill. They said their children in particular were going through some mental and physical stresses brought on by the disaster. The survey was done by researchers with the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. The center's president is Dr. Erwin Redliner. He's also a pediatrician, and we spoke with him back in 2010, and he's with us once again. Dr. Redliner, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle. Glad to be here.
Now, just to recap, when your team did the survey in 2010, parents were reporting that their kids suffered some serious effects like depression, sleep disorders, some behavioral problems. I wanted to ask if these conditions have abated at all, or are they continuing?
This is the key question, and as it turns out, we are right now in the middle of a study to take another look at how the families are faring, not only in the coasts of Louisiana, Mississippi, but also into the coasts of Alabama and Florida. But and the field teams are out there right now talking to families every day, and the preliminary results are, and you know, this is obviously, I just want to emphasize, it's anecdotal, it's not analyzed, but there is a strong impression by our field interviewers that both mental health and physical health concerns continue to be a problem for families in the Gulf, especially with children.
Talking about the physical conditions that you talked about, you talked at the time when we first spoke about this that kids were experiencing, you know, coughing, wheezing, rashes. And I understand, again, that this is, again, anecdotal evidence. You've just gone back out into the field. Your teams have. But what are you hearing on that score?
Well, we're hearing that something on the order of 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 children so far are being reported as having worsened symptoms of wheezing and coughing and some rashes and things of that nature. And obviously, we're going to have to really get into the data and analyze this information. But the fact of the matter is there's every reason to believe that we're going to find a persistent problem with the physical ailments that parents were concerned about a year out.
One of the things I was interested in asking you about is what are you most concerned about, you know, as a person, as a pediatrician, but also a person with a long-term interest in, you know, both the physical and mental health of families and communities over time? What are you most concerned about, if I may ask?
We are definitely concerned that this kind of trauma for children that has both mental health as well as physical health impacts can have very long-term effects in children and can carry through in terms of chronic illnesses, but also, you know, we're worried about will kids be able to succeed in school and what is the general well-being like? And we are really concerned. Many of these families in the Gulf were not particularly well off economically to begin with. Some were doing just fine, but then businesses were really cut back after the spill, so there's been a lot of stress economically and otherwise. We're finding already families who have been living doubled up or tripled up with friends or other family. This is very difficult for these kids and their families. So I am definitely concerned just from a lot of clinical experience that there will be long-term impact of this, but really we need to verify this data before we make any definitive statements.
What about the medical infrastructure to treat these concerns, both treatment for physical conditions and for mental health conditions? I think a lot of people will remember that the medical infrastructure, along with everything else, was severely disrupted after Hurricane Katrina, you know,
right,
a couple of years before that. And I was wondering whether enough of that infrastructure had been restored to so that people can get treatment for the issues that they're now dealing with because of the BP oil spill.
Well, that's a great question. And actually, the lack of health care access and challenges getting to health care is one of the preconditions that was a problem actually even before Katrina. So Plaquemines Parish, which is one of the hardest hit areas in terms of the oil spill down the very southern tip of Louisiana, already had terrible lack of pediatric resources and primary care availability for families to begin with. This even predates Katrina and certainly predates the BP oil spill. So now we have this catastrophic event with lots of long-term consequences from it and real difficulties for families who need to get health care. So that's why the Children's Health Fund is down there. We'll be down there for the as long as we can. But it's really a really big problem. So the infrastructure, not good to begin with, is still very much a factor in getting care for these families.
Dr. Erwin Redliner is a pediatrician and professor of clinical population and family health. He's also the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. And as we said, he's in the middle of surveying families and public officials about how the BP oil spill has affected them. He was with us from our bureau in New York, but I'm going to ask Dr. Redliner to stand by as we bring in another guest. We want to talk with one of the people we've been checking in with from time to time to talk about how the BP oil spill that was 2 years ago, as we said, has been affecting people along along the Gulf. Many people are still struggling to restore their businesses, including Byron Enkelade. He runs an oyster business in the town of Pointe a la Hache in Louisiana. He's the president of the Louisiana Oystermen Association. We've been checking in with him over the past 2 years to see how he's doing. He's with us from New Orleans. Mr. Enkelade, thanks so much for talking with us again as well.
Thank you for having me.
Byron, let's talk a little bit about you, if we could. I just want to mention that oysters take a very long time to mature. It can take, what, anywhere from 2 to 3 years, sometimes 2 to 5 years, and some of the reef beds were completely destroyed. So can I just ask, you know, how are you making it right now?
We have been totally relying on the claims process would have failed us. So, yes, we are optimistic now, because we have just had went through a process where the court have taken it over, and basically we're seeing some, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel. So we have a long road to go. We have a lot of money that we have to spend in reinvestment. Those that could afford those have already started their reinvestment to build their oyster farms back. But we still have a long way to go, and it's going to take a lot of money to reinvest to get it back.
So really, right now, you have to kind of restore the oyster beds. There's really no production going on at all right now in your area. Is that right?
Absolutely. The Pointe a la Hache community is completely dead. The oyster economy is dead in the water. So even though we're still looking for 3 to 5 years out, but we haven't started to recover because we haven't saw the reproduction. There's no little oysters. There's no baby oysters out there in our area.
I understand also that, you know, your business had a lot of different elements to it. You also had a trucking company, which makes sense to kind of deliver the product to people. What's the trucking company doing? What's going on with that?
I've completely dismantled it. I had no other choice. I had to liquidate it. There's no way I could have, you know, afford to keep the trucks under insurance, the drivers employed. Some of them have went on and got employment other places. It's going to be extremely difficult. So that part of it I've liquidated. The boats, of course, that is the backbone of my business, oysters. So we're just hanging on, you know, and hopefully with the new transition period now, hopefully we could secure the funds we need to reinvest to start our recovery.
Is there anything that you would particularly want people to know about what's going on in your community that you think they perhaps might not know?
Well, I think the doctor just shed a lot of light to it, the mental health part of it. You know, that was something we've always felt been overlooked, especially in our community that's been basically put under a lot of stress, the family, the children in the school. We can't, even our veterans, you know, a lot of people don't realize we have a lot of Vietnam veterans who are already suffering from PTSD and Vietnam and those that's coming back. This is where they relieved themselves to get on that water. That's peace of mind. And we've lost that. So we have that problem. I know the VA is dealing with it. So that was something I think overlooked. And when we look at our Asian community, which make up the majority of our fishermen in Lower Plaquemine, we're talking about the people that came through in the 70s. That fled Vietnam under very stressful situations. Some of them lost their family, their parents. And now we're talking about situations that are putting a lot of stress on those communities.
Before we let you go, Mr. Enkelade, do you mind if I ask, how are you doing?
I'm holding up. I'm doing fine. You know, it's one thing about the Bayou people, you know. We're a very diverse community, and we just talked about the Asian Americans. We have the Croatian community. And the people are very resilient. We're going to stand. I mean, these people have endured hardships even coming to America. We're going to do what we have to do. We're not going to fade away. We've dealt with controversy, and we're going to continue fighting.
Dr. Redlener, did you want to give us a final thought before we let you both go?
We struggle so much in the U.S. in terms of learning from previous experiences. You know, in the big picture world, I am worried that at the end of the day, if something like this were to happen again, we won't be much better prepared to cope with the human aspects of this tragedy.
Well, we'll stay on top of it. to our building. Dr. Erwin Redliner, that's who was speaking just now, is a pediatrician and professor of clinical population and family health. He's the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. And as you heard earlier, he is conducting another survey of families and public officials about how the BP oil spill has affected them. He was with us from our bureau in New York. With us from New Orleans, Byron Encalade. He's an oysterman from the Louisiana coast. He's the president of the Louisiana Oysterman Association. He was with us from New Orleans, and we've been checking in with him from time to time to see how he's doing over the past 2 years. Mr. Encalade, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Redliner, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
My pleasure, too.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. It's been 2 years since the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. The accident killed 11 rig workers and unleashed the worst oil spill in U.S. history. The oil stopped flowing long ago, and BP has spent billions of dollars to clean up beaches and waterways. But this important question lingers. Is the disaster over? NPR's Debbie Elliott went to the Gulf Coast to find an answer.
Oil fouled some 1,100 miles of shoreline when the blown-out well was gushing unchecked, but on most spots along the Gulf Coast today, you don't see obvious signs of the spill. Here in Orange Beach, Alabama, the clear emerald waters of the Gulf roll onto sugar-white sand beaches.
You know, we have a nice clean beach now, night and day from 2 years ago.
Philip West is the environmental manager for the city and battled the globs of orangey-brown crude that washed ashore.
And you know, one of the great things that I can say about the beach now is we got our squeak back, which indicates to me the sand is clean. It doesn't have that WD-40 feel to it like we had during the spill.
But as we squeak along in the sand and take a closer look, there's a lingering problem.
It's like a little fragment, tarball.
He finds several quarter-sized clumps of weathered oil. BP crews still scour the beaches here daily. West says there tends to be a spike in tarballs like this after a storm moves through, churning up the surf.
Which, you know, 2 years later indicates that there's a source somewhere nearby, and about the only source that could be would be a submerged tar mat. So that still concerns us a little bit.
West says what's out of sight isn't necessarily out of mind.
There was cancer. Maybe we're in remission. We just have to watch it constantly from now on.
Scientists are watching, too. Scores of public and private research projects are underway to determine the impact of the spill, including the federally mandated natural resources damage assessment, which will help determine how much BP should pay for polluting the Gulf. Early findings indicate damage to deepwater coral reefs, mangroves, dolphin, and some fish species. But scientists warn showing cause and effect in a large ecosystem like the Gulf of Mexico is a challenge. And it's exacerbated by the lack of baseline data on the state of the Gulf pre-spill. Still, the problems don't appear to be as severe as some predicted when the disaster was unfolding.
We were panic-stricken.
George Crozier is the former director of the Dauphin Island Sea Lab, south of Mobile. 2 years later, he's less afraid.
I don't see this changing the ecosystem of the North Central Gulf. I don't see it tipping something into catastrophe.
Crozier says the acute impacts on the Gulf don't appear widespread, but he says it will take decades to understand the chronic problems the spill created, problems that are dealing a severe blow to an already fragile coast in South Louisiana.
Are you ready?
Captain Dave Marino from Myrtle Grove navigates a center console bay boat through the Barataria Basin, a collection of canals, bays, and bayous south of New Orleans on the west side of the Mississippi River.
And it's real deep through here, and the tide comes in and out real, real strong here. And that's a lot of the reason why the area that was affected by the oil got the oil, because it pulled it through like a funnel almost, an hourglass, I guess.
This region suffered some of the heaviest oiling, accumulating in what's known as Bay Jimmy. On a tiny marsh island here, David Muth with the National Wildlife Federation shows me how the oil has persisted in the environment.
Well, here you go. You can actually see oil seeping out right here. Just coming up out of the peat. Thick, liquid oil 2 years later. And look, you can see little fiddler crabs popping out from down in there, and they're down in that oil.
There are also pools of water with fresh oil sheen on top, large tar balls, and on the edge of the marsh, dead sections now covered with hardened oil.
That's where there was a layer of oil that is weathered now, and it's just a thick layer of tar that prevents the grass from growing up through it.
It's almost like you would see on a road. It looks like asphalt.
Yeah, well, the term is asphaltine, and that's a pretty good description of it. And if you smell it, that's what it smells like. It smells like fresh asphalt.
The question, he says, is can the Gulf ecosystem recover after absorbing some 200 million gallons of oil?
The deep concern is not so much about this, which is so visible, but this is an indication that the stuff stays in the system. There's no magic bullet for an oil spill. Once you spill oil, you have spilled oil, and there's no putting it back.
This spill took the hardest toll on a system already in decline. Louisiana loses the equivalent of a football field of land every 15 minutes. And the oil, still fouling 200 miles of shore, has accelerated the erosion in places like Bay Jimmy. Captain Dave Marino has watched it happen.
You can see it's falling apart. You know, just right here where the boat's parked last year was land. All of it's getting eaten up because it's, you know, the vegetation's dead.
Fishermen here want Congress to approve a plan to steer BP fines for Gulf restoration projects, like diverting Mississippi River water and sediments to rebuild marsh. Ryan Lambert has been a Cajun fishing and hunting guide for 31 years and is alarmed by the decline he's seen in the last two.
This island should be covered with shorebirds, and there are none. They ought to be nesting in here. Any island before the oil spill, you come up to an island like this, and you can't even hear yourself think. And look, it's void of life.
Lambert says his speckled trout catch is down 98%.
You know, we're used to going out to right here where this water's coming through and can pick up 40 fish right there, no problem, in a half hour. You go try to catch a fish there right now. That's not happening.
Lambert says he's tired of hearing that everything is fine. Come on down. A message in some of BP's ads.
You know, our whole life is upside down, on hold, waiting on to see what happens.
2 years later, he says, it's not fine. It's far from over. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The U.S. Forest Service has a cow problem. Six dead cows that were discovered inside a cabin, piled up and frozen solid in the Colorado backcountry. The cabin is at Conundrum Hot Springs at 11,200 feet, accessible only by a precipitous hike, and rangers are trying to figure out how to get rid of the carcasses before they decompose. Scott Snelson is district ranger for the Aspen Sopris District of the White River National Forest, where the cows were found, and he joins me now. And Scott, how did the cows get into the cabin, do you think?
Well, we have grazing permits on the forest, and our neighboring forest on the Gunnison side had a couple of wandering, or actually 29 wandering cows that came over from the other side over quite a long distance. And they found shelter at the Conundrum Hot Spring site once it started snowing.
Well, what are the problems that you're worried about that these cows might cause as the weather heats up, the snow melts, and they start to decompose?
Well, we're concerned primarily about bears are coming out from their hibernation, and they're awful hungry. So we've got a lot of hikers eager to go up there with our early snow melt, and we want to make sure that folks don't get hurt, and if we've got aggressive bears up there, that we don't get the bears in trouble as well.
Is there a concern about water contamination, too?
Sure. It's possible that some bears can haul that stuff around and get it in the waterway. And with as popular of a recreational site, water contamination is of concern.
Well, Scott, I guess the conundrum up at Conundrum Hot Springs is what to do about these carcasses. This area, I gather, is off limits to vehicles, right? You can't haul them out.
That's correct.
And what other options are there then?
Well, we can close the trail until the nature takes care of the carrion. The other thing we can do is oftentimes we'll use explosives to break those things up into smaller pieces so scavengers can clean those up a little bit quicker. And we are looking at the opportunity to potentially have a big bonfire with that cabin and take care of the carcasses in the process.
Uh-huh. So you might blow up the whole cabin or burn the cabin down.
Yeah, the explosive option is an option that we'll keep in our toolbox. Blowing up carcasses is a little bit of an inexact science. Oftentimes you don't get it quite in the size of pieces that you, that you'd like to see for quick cleanup. So it's likely that we're going to do a little burning up there.
Have you ever seen a problem like this before? A number of cows in this site, and you mentioned that there may be others that you just haven't found yet. They're still under the snow.
Yeah, cows and other wildlife certainly die by the thousands on the National Forest every year. This is really not that far out of the ordinary. It's just sort of an interesting twist on it. It just seems to have caught people's interest.
Yeah, it's just the one that we, just this one that we said media people care about, clearly.
It is pretty juicy story. Conundrum Creek, cows in a cabin, explosives, potentially a big barbecue. Yeah, I can see why people are interested.
Well, good luck with the cleanup. I hope it goes well. Thanks for talking to us about it.
My pleasure.
That's Scott Snelson, District Ranger for the Aspen-Sopris District of the White River National Forest in Colorado, talking about how they plan to get rid of six dead cows frozen in a cabin, and maybe others, high in the Rocky Mountains.